This has been a convention of historic feats, historic achievements, and people who had a vision and made those visions reality. One such vision was flying around the world nonstop, non-refueled, solo. Today you saw the Virgin Atlantic Global Flyer arrive at Oshkosh, its first public appearance, to share that feat, that historic aircraft, and the trials and tribulations of accomplishing that mission is an honor for all of us. Tonight, let's welcome the pilot, the visionary who made that all possible, Steve Fawcett. Steve?
I gotta show you something first. Well, actually, this isn't the Virgin Global Flyer, but I just have to tell you about this flight we did earlier this month because it is such a neat project. This is the Vickers Vimy. Our mission was to recreate the first transatlantic airplane flight, which was done by John Alcock and Arthur Whidden Brown in 1919. The route was from St. John's, Newfoundland to Clifton, Ireland. And it preceded Charles Lindbergh's much more celebrated flight by 8 years. This Vimy is a replica, except for the modern engines. It's a true replica, and it handles like the original, which is not necessarily good. I had to hang on to the yoke, operate the rudders for the entire 18 hours and 15 minutes of this transatlantic flight. My co-pilot and I had to focus on the instruments because the flight was mostly in instrument conditions. Here we are setting up for the landing in Clifton, Ireland. Actually, there's no airport in Clifton, Ireland. Alcock and Brown landed in a bog and pretty much crashed the airplane. Best we could do is a golf course, Connemara Championship Golf Course. I took great pleasure in calling out my downwind, base, and final to fairway 8. So here we are coming in for our touchdown on fairway 8 on the golf course. We didn't have a whole lot of faith. You can see the orange spot there. That's our life raft stashed behind the cockpit. And then Mark Rebholz on the right. We're both wearing our ocean survival suits, and I also assure you each of us was carrying a personal EPIRB in our pockets in case we went down. Well, we made it, and to the great thrill and enthusiasm of the citizenry of Clifton, Ireland, this is the most excitement that they've had in Clifton, Ireland since 1919, so they said. And It was great because they threw us a parade, sent us on a parade through the downtown of Clifton, and then through a gala party for which was truly inspirational. But I just had to do a little show and tell before I tell you about the Global Flyer. What was we've asked the question: What is the most important thing remaining to be done in aviation? And this is a question which we were discussing at Baron Hilton's Flying Ranch 6 years ago. At that time, Bertrand Picard and Brian Jones had just won the magnificent competition which we had to make the first balloon flight around the world. So we must look for different horizons. Dick Rutan, who was at the dinner, had made the Voyager flight with Gina Yeager, now told me that it was possible to make a solo around-the-world airplane flight. This immediately appealed to me because it would be a solo flight and it would be an aviation milestone. A few weeks later, Dick introduced me to Bert Rutan here at Oshkosh. And Bert did have a concept for the design of a solo around-the-world aircraft. But there were issues that still remained. And one of the issues was that got to have the right engine. The Voyager did it by having two propeller engines. You wouldn't want to do it with just one propeller engine because propeller engines have some reliability considerations. But I wanted the reliability of a jet engine, and I also wanted this to be a speed record when I did the round the world. So we sought a fuel-efficient jet engine. At first, we looked at something that's been developed by the Air Force back in the 1970s, the oil crisis, as a more fuel-efficient engine. But that was called an F-109 engine, and it was in a box, no potential of any support, and we would have to figure out how to maintain this engine on our own. Then we realized that Dr. Sam Williams, who built Williams International on building a small fan jet engine for cruise missiles. Williams was already making jet engines for small business jets, and he offered the engine currently used in the Citation CJ-2. And I love the idea of getting the reliability, not only of a jet engine, but a one that is in current production. The second problem that had to be overcome was an autopilot. It's absolutely necessary for a solo flight. And we needed a digital autopilot instead of an analog autopilot, so that it would be more readily programmable for this application. TrueTrack, a very small company in Springdale, Arkansas, it already started making digital autopilots, and maybe some of you have it because it's their primary market is home-built airplanes. This was the solution. This gave us the equipment that we needed to proceed with the development of an airplane. Scale Composites team was sensational on this whole project, and in particular, there's one person, John Karkow, who became the key man in the project. It's an extraordinary example of how an aeronautical engineer can carry a lot of responsibility in a small company. He managed the detailed design, Global Flyer, managed the construction, and became the test pilot. The development of the Virgin Global Flyer was a huge success. The plane demonstrated good flight handling from its very first test flight. The testing program was at Mojave, California, and lasted 10 months, 27 flights, totaling 130 hours. John Karkow did the initial flight testing, and then I flew eight of the test flights. There were decisions to make. This airplane is takeoff critical. When the engineers sit down and figure out how much runway will be needed to take off with a full load of fuel, the calculation was 8,000 feet. But would we really know? It wasn't really practical to test this airplane with full fuel. In fact, it's not the kind of thing you want to send another test pilot up to do, because that was my job, to be the ultimate test pilot to fly it for the first time with full fuel. So Scale advocated that I should start the round-the-world flight at Edwards Air Force Base in Southern California because it has a 15,000-foot runway. I decided on Salina, Kansas, because for the finish of the round the world, I wanted to be over land. The Virgin Global Flyer has a glide ratio of 37 to 1 with zero thrust. And with a windmilling engine, it'll glide over 300 miles from its cruise altitude of 45,000 feet. So I could run the risk of running out of fuel anywhere over the United States because I know I could fly a glider to a nearby airport. But if I were finishing the flight in California, because I had started at Edwards Air Force Base, I'd be running the risk of running out of fuel between Hawaii and California, and that could be deadly. With the decision of Salina, I got this 12,300-foot runway, which had recently been resurfaced. In addition, I got the use of an old Strategic Air Command hangar, and the unequivocal support of everybody in Salina, including the Aviation School of Kansas State University. Kansas State designated 7 aviation maintenance students who were already held their A&P mechanics credentials to assist the scaled crew led by Philip Grasso. K-State also provided named 4 students from their professional pilot program, shown here with me and my wife. The pilot students worked directly with me and the mission control director, Kevin Stass, in the flight planning and simulation of tailwind scenarios. So they were directly involved in this project. My meteorologist, David Dienau from Belgium, who had been my assistant meteorologist on my round-the-world balloon flight, tracked the jet streams and turbulence beginning in mid-January. Finally, the desired weather pattern was found for a launch on February 28th. The Global Flyer was fueled to its maximum takeoff weight of 22,100 pounds. That's an unprecedented fuel fraction of 83%. The remaining 17% of this weight was the airplane and me. The previous highest fuel fraction was 72% on an airplane, which was the Voyager. With Virgin Atlantic on hand as a title sponsor and Sir Richard Branson being right there and personally involved in this project all the way, this was really showtime. Patiently, I would have to wait through the afternoon of February 28th because there's over 20 knots of wind, and I didn't want the turbulence associated with that wind. So as the sun went down, I was ready to take off and the wind died. Scaled performance engineer Clint Nichols was in the tower making call-outs of speeds at each taxiway intersection. I was briefed beforehand on the required speeds at each point that would be necessary in order to get to the airborne before the end of the 12,300-foot runway. So on my takeoff roll, we had the speeds required at each taxiway intersection. At the crossing of the first taxiway, I was actually behind the required speed to get off the runway in time, but then the acceleration improved to my great relief, and I was off the ground exactly 8,000 feet, as the engineers had predicted in the preliminary design of the aircraft. My initial climb to 39,000 feet seemed quite normal, but upon crossing into Canada, a message blared in my earphones, GPS failure. Well, this could certainly be a showstopper because GPS is my only form of navigation. Turns out that there was an incompatibility between the GPS software, which was based on the new WAAS system, the Wide Area Augmentation System, and my flight management system. This incompatibility wasn't observed before, and was only observed when you leave the United States. After 2/10 hours, though, I crossed the border, after I crossed into Canada, the GPS automatically readjusted to the older system. There's dangers on this flight that we really don't often like to talk about. This is a pressurized airplane, so oxygen is only needed in case of depressurization. Unfortunately, my oxygen controls had an unguarded switch, which was located at the entry of the aircraft. So I must have bumped that emergency oxygen switch while climbing in or moving equipment around at the start of the flight. When I checked in the morning, there was no oxygen left in the bottle. So the stakes of this flight had just gone up dramatically because a single-engine jet means that's your only source of pressurization air, which means if the engine fails, I would have no oxygen. So in jets, we practice emergency descents. Put on the oxygen mask and pull out the speed brakes and dive to a safe altitude. Global Flyer doesn't have speed brakes, doesn't even have flaps. And it's so slick that it would take a very long time to slip down to a survivable altitude, like 25,000 feet. So this was a sobering thought. So the flight continued across the Atlantic and North Africa. Here I am over Morocco. And joined the powerful subtropical jet stream in Egypt, which would boost my ground speed by about 100 knots until I got beyond Hawaii. Sensational jet stream. But about halfway into the flight, they broke the bad news to me. I'd lost a large amount of fuel and probably would not be able to make it to the finish. Thoughts started to cross my mind of the complications of that would result in having to land someplace like, well, I thought of Hong Kong, Nagasaki, Honolulu. But most of all, it would be a disappointment of not being able to complete this flight. Virgin Global Flyer has 13 fuel tanks and a very sophisticated fuel management system. However, the probes in the tanks are famously inaccurate, and the totalizer, which which calculates the fuel that's actually burned, completely failed. So it took a long time for my team to realize what exactly had happened to my fuel, why I didn't have enough fuel. They finally determined the amount of missing fuel was 3,100 pounds. That's a huge amount when you consider the total capacity of fuel of 18,000 pounds. And this airplane originally was designed only to make it around the world with 1,000 pounds of reserve. Well, we now know what happened. The largest tanks, the booms, have their fuel vent exit here, shown on this slide, on the engine pylon. This was an unfortunate choice of design. It was intended to reduce wind resistance by not having a fuel vent sticking out in the airflow. But when the tanks are close to full, the vent line would fill up with fuel. When that happens, the fuel is pushed out the fuel vent as the air expands with altitude. And that's part of it. But the other part of the fuel problem was that you have return fuel, that is, fuel that goes to the engine that is not burned and continues to circulate back into the fuel tanks. This is a larger part of fuel. But because the tanks were then had pressure on them, because there was air pressure in the tanks, that return fuel did not return into the tanks, but also forced out, out the fuel vent. So the fuel that I lost, 3,100 pounds, was lost in the second and third hours of the flight. It was streaming out at a rate of 4 gallons a minute over Canada. But when enough fuel was gone to create an air bubble through the boom tanks and the inboard wing tanks, the fuel system worked normally. Anyhow, by good fortune, we had a very good forecast for winds. And nevertheless, so by the time I'd gotten halfway across the Pacific, I was confident that I had enough fuel to make it back to Kansas. The average tailwind on my global flight was 72 knots, and the airplane design was based on having 50 knots of tailwind around the world. Fortunately, I was flying on the best wind forecast of the season. We have now put new fuel vents, and this is from a recent test flight. You see these posts sticking up out of the booms. And the fuel fuel loss problem should not recur. You're probably wondering what it was like flying the Global Flyer. The cockpit was generally well organized. Some of the instrumentation is common to other jet aircraft. Much of it was unique. On the left are the gauges and fuel transfer switches, actually quite a sophisticated system. In the center is the Chelton flight management system, which is as sophisticated as you might find in other jet aircraft. To the right are the autopilots and the flight recorders. The seat was big enough to shift around, and I would recline if I desired. I never reclined the seat, however, because I wanted to have immediate access to all the information and controls. I did sleep, but in a very controlled manner. We had an extensive alerting system for things like changes in altitude, pressurization, engine function, and speed. I would also set a countdown timer so I wouldn't oversleep. You can see here in this slide I was wearing plug-type earphones, which were left over from my race car driving days. And I had to wear these all the time because this is the way I would hear the alarms. The most common alarm was airspeed, which is triggered by any change of 3 knots in airspeed. There were actually a total of 4 nights of flying. This is because even though it's a 67-hour flight, I was flying eastbound around the world. In two of those 4 nights, I did not sleep at all. That is the first and the last night. And the other 2 nights, I took frequent naps of 1 to 5 minutes. So my total sleeping time was about 1 hour for the entire flight. That sounds outrageous. But it is interesting how much value you get out of taking naps. And this seemed to work. I felt good all the way up to landing. But when I went to the victory party that night, I didn't feel so good. You're probably wondering, so I'll tell you that about these other things. You know, peeing is really easy. You know, you just take a take 1 liter bottles, and then I could empty those out actually through a fitting through the pressure hull. But you know, the prospect of number two was a very disturbing thought. Yeah, on a 3-day flight. So to minimize the risk, I went on a low residue diet for 3 days before the flight. And then a liquid diet during the flight. My food during the flight was a total of 12 cans of Slim Fast diet milkshakes. As a precaution, my aviation doctor had supplied me with what the hospitals call fecal containment bags, which, well, you can just kind of stick them on. I did get the urge on the third night, and after struggling to get everything ready, I finally decided I really didn't have to go that bad after all. So, once I was assured that I had sufficient fuel, it was clear flying. But notice some things about this route. When in the center of the United States at the start point, I flew northeast to Newfoundland, Canada. And this is may not seem entirely logical, but everything was based on trying to reduce the vulnerability of this airplane while it was fully loaded with fuel. This airplane fully loaded with fuel can only survive 2 G's of load. Actually, when it's empty, it can survive 4 G's. So what this meant was that I had to avoid any significant turbulence, and there's often turbulence associated with jet streams. So I flew away from the jet streams in the early part of the flight until I burned down some fuel. That's why I went up to Newfoundland, Canada. Once I got back down in the middle of the Atlantic, then I got into the smooth air and wanted to be in the jet streams. You'll also notice a big zigzag of where I went beyond Hawaii off route. This diversion was to add length to the route. To qualify as an official round-the-world record, a flight must have the length of the Tropic of Cancer, which is 22,880 statute miles. I could declare waypoints. I pre-declared 49 waypoints around the world, which would give me that required, exactly that required length. And I was required to overfly each of those waypoints. Then, so after making it back to the United States, then came the good part. I was over Alamosa, Colorado, which is 400 miles from the finish line. Pulled the throttle to idle and started a final glide to Salina, Kansas. There's one more problem. When I turned the switches, when I got close to Salina and I was ready to put the gear down, nothing happened. Well, then the two main gear came down and the lights went on, but the nose gear would not. We knew from testing that the nose gear was a little slow when it was cold, and it was really cold after this flight. But this certainly would be a shame to finish the global flyer flight by coming in on main gear and scraping away the nose of the airplane. So I turned north away from Salina to deal with a problem. First, I tried to slow the aircraft down to get the gear door open with little wind resistance. But the gear lowers forward. So after the gear door was open, I took it up to maximum redline speed in order to pull the nose gear down. After a long 10 minutes, I finally succeeded and announced 3 greens. So I proceeded to land. You saw the approach, and here I am coming in for the touchdown. The rollout and a tremendously enthusiastic crowd in Salina, Kansas, came out to see this beautiful airplane. And here they are. They had to go around and visit with all of them. It was a great experience. The results of the flight were very satisfying. Guinness Book of Records was on hand to deliver a certificate for the first solo nonstop airplane flight around the world. Fédération Aéronautique Internationale is the official certifying organization for aviation world records. And there are There are seven absolute world records for airplanes. So my time for this flight was 67 hours and allowed me to gain the not only the first solo nonstop airplane flight, but also the absolute world record for speed around the world. This is the first time one of the seven absolute world records had been broken in almost 19 years. The last, again, was Dick Rutan, Jeannie Yeager, and Voyager. Also broke two of the jet-only records that were held by the big guys. The distance without landing was previously held by a B-52 flying from Okinawa to Spain. Also, the distance over a closed course was held by an Antonov freighter at 12,500 miles. So it's hard to predict the influence this flight will have, if any. But this airplane is interesting because it's close to the mainstream of aviation. It's jet powered, and it places a premium on fuel economy. It demonstrates the advantages of lightweight carbon construction, where the airline industry is still lugging around aluminum airframes. Flight was an adventure, which I wanted to do regardless of the benefits to aviation. In fact, many of the most influential flights in the early decades of aviation were also adventures, yet they were the flights that demonstrated new thinking and development in air travel. So I know why I did this flight. It wasn't any effort to become a celebrity, which will never fit me, but to make an achievement which I can be personally proud of. I've been encouraged by the enthusiasm of people everywhere, many of them who have recognized the essential character of the effort, that persistence, risk, and the importance of building a strong team and the technology of planning this flight were what was most interesting. For those that have thought that all the major adventures have been done, I hope that I've shown that there are many great projects to take on. And I, for one, will set new goals and be looking forward to coming years. Thank you.
Thank you.